Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business. From liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
You know success when you see it, or you think you do, the people in the spotlight. But what about those small business masterminds who succeed at making their money work harder? They do that by having a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, which now earns 5% annual percentage yield. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
Bloomberg Audio Studios.
Podcasts, radio, news.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Intelligence Podcast. Catch us live weekdays at 10 a.m. Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. Listen on demand wherever you get your podcasts or watch us live on YouTube.
Okay, one of the stocks in the news is L'Oreal, the cosmetics company. Put out some good numbers here. Let's break it down with Deb Aiken. She is a luxury goods analyst for Bloomberg Intelligence. She joins us from London via Zoom. So, Deb, L'Oreal Cosmetics, I've come to understand just really through the pandemic from my observation of the Sephora store across the street from Bloomberg headquarters, people buy cosmetics like no matter what is going on in the world. What did you learn from L'Oreal's numbers?
Feel good factor, right, Paul? actually the numbers came in above 9%. So there was a big pickup from 4Q where we had a solid first half and a slower second half in 2023 across the whole of the beauty industry. And so we had a big beat on the Q1, just a sales number, but it was really about double-digit growth in Europe. We then saw high single-digit growth when we pull away anomalies in the US. Definitely emerging markets, like 15, 16% growth there. And the other side of it was that mass market is also holding up, because luxury right now in beauty is difficult if you're a company like L'Oreal or Estee Lauder or Beiersdorf's La Prairie with exposure in skincare in China, where in-trade travel retail is still stuffed with skincare. So that still takes another quarter to normalize. But elsewhere, mass market, passing on pricing, do very well across makeup, across fragrances in particular. Yeah, it's all going well.
Yeah, it's interesting. And just talk to us about the cosmetics business in general. Again, I just was, you know, while everything was shutting down in New York City during the pandemic, the Sephora store across the street stayed open, number one. And number two, there were people in there every day. I don't care what was going on in the world. They were there every day. Talk to us about just the overall cosmetics market, the growth characteristics of that market.
So typically we look at a market. I cover the luxury market too. And we're in this year, we're looking at a normalized growth rate in luxury goods of 5 to 6%. And you could say that we're looking at that rate too. And I'm finding over the last several years that the beauty industry is growing in line with the luxury industry. And that's because there's more and more premiumization and ultra high end. And that is finding the same growth rate and profitability in some cases as the luxury industry. So you typically get a 3 to 5% growth rate from mass market and 5% upwards on premium and then super premium and luxury type products. It's a feel good factor. It's for everyone. You know, over the last few years, Sephora stores, for example, are within a selective retailing division, which sits in LVMH, the owner of Louis Vuitton Moët Hennessy. Right. It's about making sure that the product in there is innovative. There's a lot of new product coming out. L'Oreal talked about AI using it to look at the scalp, look at skincare. Their professional hair care division was really high, looking at the hair care and the scalp and what's going on there. Really? So it's been used in so many ways. And also because of social media and the way that you can really get to understand how the cosmetics products, and dermatology, for example, has grown. When I look at the L'Oreal numbers, 20 to 30% plus every quarter for, wow, since 2020. So it's now become 20% of their business very quickly, when a couple of years ago we were talking about it being 10%.
Well, yeah.
So it's having belief. It's feel good, but it's also got like a healthy side to it as well.
Well, that's what my co-host Alex Steele, that's what she always says. She invests in her face. Now, guys like,
yes,
John Tucker and Joe Mysak and I, we obviously missed that train, so that's too late. But yeah, I think that seems to be a thing. All right, Deb, let's step back a little bit and just talk about what you're seeing in luxury overall. If I go to the high streets in London and Paris, how's traffic out there? How's business?
I think what we've seen overall, was certainly Europe is really been the surprise now for the third quarter. We just started with the earnings season, but now for the third quarter, more robust than we expected. We're getting a lot of local tourism, because I think if we think about Europe in particular, 22, we had the dollar over here spending, strength of the dollar into Europe, beginning of 23, and that phased out the second half of 2023. But the Europeans are doing particularly well, with new designs, new products, new designers. But it is really the very high end where you're getting, and also what you know, that quiet luxury. The view of products like Loro Piana, Brunello Cucinelli. We just had their results this week. Very, very strong. Really, really decent teens growth. And so there are brands out there, but it tends to be that they really are the luxury price tag, and it's value for money at that price point. You don't have many of those products in your wardrobe, and you're proud to wear them, and they're the ones that are driving the business. It's across all categories too. We're talking from cashmere to very high-end leather goods, to high-end fragrances. We're seeing more and more, I suppose we're seeing more and more momentum in very high-end fragrances as well, with acquisitions, yep, coming through and IPOs as well.
Hey, Deb, you know, when we talk about, I know just reading your research, talking to you in the past, the Chinese consumer is really a big, big, important player in the world of luxury spending, both, you know, home in China, but also abroad, as the Chinese consumer travels to New York, to London, to Paris, and Italy, for example. Talk to us about China. Is that a net positive or net negative? Where are we here?
Yeah, so net negative. So if we think about, let's focus pre-pandemic. And we had a travel event last week in London. We're looking at where the Chinese consumer was. So in terms of the Chinese consumer as part of luxury goods, pre-pandemic, a third of the business, we now think they're back to around 23%. But how that's changed in terms of geography, it used to be that they scored less than, so if we think about the luxury industry, around 10% was Chinese spent and at home. Now it's 16% Chinese spent and at home. So we have these conflicting numbers. China's up double digit, but China's still below where it was, and that is true. But it's the US consumer and the European consumer who've taken a lot of the slack, and that's why the industry versus 2019 overall for luxury goods is around 35 to 40% bigger than it was.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
That's
okay.
That's how you know you've got double digit, high single digit growth growing annually.
All right. I mean, I'll walk down to Penn Station today, down Fifth Avenue or Madison Avenue, and I'll see a lot of people in those stores here. All right, Deb, thanks so much for joining us there. Deb Aiken, luxury goods analyst for Bloomberg Intelligence. She's based in London, and she's really one of the best analysts out there covering a lot of retail, but really focusing on the luxury space. And as Deb says, you know, has been telling us, that's a good, solid to mid-high single-digit growth business, you know, well above GDP. And that kind of goes to some of the wealth creation out there and widening gaps there in wealth inequality. It's not just in the U.S. or in the Western markets. It's also in Asia as well. So Debs gives us some of the best research out there. L'Oreal, again, the cosmetics company, reported some better than expected numbers. And the stock is up 5% today. It's about flat for the year. It's a big company, 240 billion euros in market cap. So just a huge company there.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Intelligence Podcast. Catch us live weekdays at 10 a.m. Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. You can also listen live on Amazon Alexa from our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
Of course, the geopolitical issues globally are back on the forefront here overnight. Israel retaliatory strike on Iran last night. Many folks calling it a measured response, maybe proportionate, if you will. I'm not sure how you define all that. I guess that's different for everyone. But let's check in with someone with feet on the ground, Ethan Bronner. He's the Israel bureau chief and senior Mideast editor for Bloomberg News. He joins us from Tel Aviv via Zoom. Ethan, what's the feeling on the ground in Tel Aviv today as it relates to Israel's strike on Iran last night?
I think you described it well. I think that the view here is that it what Israel did was to sort of smack at Iran at a place that says, we can get to you. There are the where it hit was at one of the air bases from which last weekend's attack came, and also not far from nuclear sites. So the Israelis, their attitude, at least their claim, I'd say the mainstream claim, is that we hit back in a way that said, we want you to know that we can do this and we're not going any further, and let's stop this here. There are those who are very upset that it wasn't sufficient. There are those who wanted nothing to happen. But I would say that, you know, it is not being criticized too heavily except from the far right right now.
Yeah, Ben Gavir, the hawkish national security minister in Israel, tweeting just one word. Weak.
Right. That word was a Hebrew phrase word for meaning more like lame or wimpy. Very, very critical.
That one word doing a lot of work here to suggest that not everyone is in agreement. And at the end of the day, Ethan, I mean, this is a big change from going Israel and Iran in the shadows fighting to now out in the open and out in open conflict. So while markets are treating it as if it's over, I mean, this is a shift, isn't it?
It's a shift. Of course, it's in many ways a shift that began not by Israel this week, but by Iran last week. That was the beginning of the big shift. Israel has been hitting on occasion inside Iran. No one's kind of acknowledged it, but two or three occasions and where with missiles and other and drones and other occasions where they have assassinated Iranian nuclear scientists and so forth. But the big change began last Saturday night when Iran said, okay, all of this stuff you guys are doing to us, both of our proxies in Iraq, Syria, Lebanon, and so forth, and now us, we're coming back at you directly. That was the change. And now Israel hitting back, saying we can't let this happen without some response. You know, the whole debate is, should there have been a response? All week, the Americans, the French, the Germans, the British were coming by personally and on the phone and saying to Prime Minister Netanyahu, let it go, take your win. You stopped all those attacks last Saturday. This is a win. You don't have to go back at them. But the Israelis felt they did, and this was their response. We'll see where it takes us. It isn't obvious that it's over. But the Iranians have been saying publicly today they don't think much happened, and they don't see any particular need to respond. So,
all right, Ethan, let's get our focus back on kind of probably where it needs to be, which is in Gaza. What's the latest thinking about Israeli strategy in Gaza? It feels like a stalemate and status quo. What's the strategy here from the Israeli government?
So they're not being exceptionally open, as you can imagine, in the middle of their deliberations. There are, you know, it's like a Rubik's Cube. There are all these things going on at once, including, of course, what's happening with Iran that we've just talked about. The Israelis began their attacks 6+ months ago. Recently, they pulled many of their troops out, but there remains in southern Gaza, in the city of Rafah, 5,000 to 8,000 Hamas troops. in tunnels and so forth, and some hundred or so Israeli hostages. Israel has been repeatedly saying that it needs to go in there eventually and take them out so that Hamas can no longer be the kind of force to do what it did on October 7th. The Americans have been saying, be careful, please don't. What about all the people who are a million plus people who are taking shelter above ground in Rafah? So I think that my instinct at the moment is that there will be some time off here as we see whether this negotiation can get anywhere in Cairo about a ceasefire, and that Israel will begin to take steps to have the civilians in Rafah moved elsewhere for some kind of operation in the coming month or two. Its scale is very difficult for me to assess at this point.
Ethan, if I could tie these two together, does the fact that Iran has struck Israel out in the open, is there a sense to which this gives the Israelis more impetus to say, look, clearly we need to be out there and we need to be strong, and again, this more hawkish attitude towards Gaza and what they say are Iranian proxies?
Yes, absolutely. But you see, it like everything, it's not one force at work here. And so what you said is true. On the other side of the equation is the fact that last Saturday, all these countries, including Jordan, Saudi Arabia, and other Arab states, helped Israel push Iran back. And Israel is feeling, in the bosom of some kind of alliance and doesn't want to mess that up either. So, I think that what it wants to do is sort of show restraint toward Iran on its mainland and get everyone to accept that it needs to do something in Gaza. And because, as you say, Hamas is, after all, funded and paid for by Iran as well.
So, Ethan, you're based in Tel Aviv. You have a good sense of kind of the common person on the street. Is there any sense that among the people of Israel that there's a sense of fatigue setting in here? It's been 6 months here. They've basically occupied Gaza. Is there a sense of that maybe the people would like to move on to the next step?
There is some of that. I don't think it's overwhelming, though, I have to tell you, Paul. I mean, there really is a sense. What happened on October 7th, it's very difficult for those abroad to grasp the sense of trauma and defeat that it created in this country, the sense that its very existence is at stake, its ability to allow people to live at the edges of its country and not feel that someone is going to come in and carve them up and unprotected. It's been so overwhelming that I think that there remains a desire here among most Israelis to, quote unquote, finish with Hamas and make clear to other militias, proxies, and enemies not far away that Israel is willing to fight for its existence. So I don't think that fatigue is the overwhelming sentiment, although you are right that it exists. And there are many who say, we've done what we can, let's cut a deal, let's get out. We can't do this forever. But I don't think I think it's still leaning in the other direction for now.
Ethan, if I can quickly ask a military amateurish question, because this I don't understand, and maybe it's a minor point, but I'd just be interested to know, when Israel, we have reports of them launching these strikes, also a report of them striking a Syrian aerial defense position, Israel never confirms them. Their official line is always one of unconfirming. Why is that?
You know, I think that their view, in particular with regard to, say, Iran, is that they view that it allows them some kind of rhetorical and strategic flexibility to not specifically say what they did. They certainly acknowledge when they attack in Lebanon and often in Syria, by the way, if they say these are Hezbollah positions that we have taken out, that goes on. In terms of the sort of scarier stuff that goes on when they take out, an alleged nuclear reactor, or when they do what they did today, they have found it useful to not talk about it publicly. I mean, Israel has nuclear weapons. It's had them for years. It has never officially acknowledged them.
Ethan, thank you so much for this reporting. Ethan Bronner, Israel Bureau Chief and Senior Mideast Editor for Bloomberg News. He's based in our Tel Aviv Bureau there. So again, fluid situation there.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. You need a company with extensive experience in specialized insurance. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and helping provide coverage that suits your needs. The Hartford offers insurance solutions that help mid to large-sized businesses, like yours, effectively manage risk, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. With extensive experience in underwriting, risk engineering services, and claims, The Hartford goes beyond the expected to deliver innovative, customizable solutions and service that your industry, that your business, demands. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Success is more than the final destination. It's a path you take one step at a time. It's discipline, it's teamwork, and it's the drive and passion inside of us that comes before all recognition. It's what Stifel's been doing for over 130 years. Quietly, yet strategically, Stifel's become one of the fastest growing wealth management and investment banking firms in the country. Our financial advisors go beyond traditional wealth management to provide clients with direct access to one of the industry's largest equity research franchises and a leading middle market investment bank. Because success is the drive it takes to keep climbing, the passion to keep investing, the best of each of us made better by the best in all of us. And that is where success meets success. Start your journey at Stifel.com. That's Stifel.com.
Stifel Nicolaus and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Intelligence Podcast. Catch us live weekdays at 10 a.m. Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. Listen on demand wherever you get your podcasts or watch us live on YouTube.
We are here in a Bloomberg Interactive Broker Studio. Danny Berger sitting in for Alex Steele, who's on holiday today and all of next week. We are here in a Bloomberg Interactive Broker Studio. We're streaming live on YouTube. That's the internet, Danny. YouTube.com.
Oh.
Search Bloomberg Podcast. Apparently, that's what the kids are doing
these
days.
Learn something new every day.
They're on this YouTube thing. Tom is all over. Tom Keeney's becoming and a new person here in this internet age. Talking about streaming and kind of internet delivery of media, it's all about Netflix. Netflix is a $250 billion market cap company. It's up 17% year to date, up 76% over the past 12 months, but it's down 6.6% today. I'm not sure what's going on there. I thought they had good numbers last night, but let's check in with somebody who gets paid to understand this stuff, Geetha Ranganathan. She is the media analyst at Bloomberg Intelligence. She's down in our Princeton office. Geetha, I thought it was a really good quarter in terms of, you know, particularly the subscriber ads. Why do you think the stock's trading down today?
Yeah, it was not just a good quarter, Paul. It was an excellent quarter. I mean, they blew out subscribers, right? We were expecting, you know, 4.5 million subscriber adds. They came in at over 9 million. It was the best first quarter ever, you know, kind of almost reminiscent of COVID times. But I think why investors are a little bit spooked ever since they reported is because they said that they're no longer going to be providing disclosure on their subscriber numbers, as well as on ARPU starting in the first quarter of 2025. And I think what that really signals is that this company is transitioning into this more mature phase. I mean, you know well, investors in the market likes transparency. And anytime you reduce disclosure, it really kind of causes a lot of uncertainty, a lot of anxiety.
If it's entering a more mature phase, Geetha, does that mean that this thing can no longer be priced as a growth stock, that the era of adding on huge amounts of subscribers, growing like gangbusters, that that's over? And so this repricing in that scenario makes sense.
So, you know, there are a couple of different things here. I think with the whole streaming wars and the media landscape as a whole, I mean, there has been kind of this shift away from this hyper-focus on just subscriber growth. I mean, there was going to be eventually some type of a wall or some type of a ceiling. The question was where it would be. Again, that question is still an open question, but I think what you have to remember with Netflix is, yes, there is going to be some limits to subscriber growth. I think we're going to see peak subscriber growth this year. It is going to start to decelerate a little bit. But I think what Netflix has managed to do, being a first mover in this space, is really scale and operating leverage. And we're seeing that in the profitability metrics. We're seeing that in the operating margin. We're seeing that in the free cash flow. And they are just way ahead of their peers. And so I think, valuation might have to take a little bit of a more modest kind of approach, or has to be maybe a little bit more cautious here. But at the same time, I mean, this is a very different company from your traditional media company, because most of them are still losing money on their streaming business. Meanwhile, you have Netflix generating close to about $9 to $10 billion in profit this year with a 25% operating margin.
Yeah, just amazing what they've done there in terms of getting to profitability, which begs the question, Geetha, how about, you can be a very profitable streaming company. We see that with Netflix. Do you think the Paramount Pluses of the world, the Disney Pluses of the world, all the other pluses out there from the media companies, can they get to a similar level of profitability too? Because right now, as you mentioned, the streaming business has been a money loser for most of the traditional media companies.
Yeah, so exactly to that point, Paul, last year when Netflix reported about $7 billion in profit, all of these other streamers combined reported the exact same amount in losses. So they lost about $7 billion. And it's going to be a little bit different story for each one of them. I don't think all of them can necessarily get to profitability. So Disney is almost on the cusp of profitability. They're probably going to break even in a couple of quarters. They have all the levers in place to kind of really make it a very profitable business. Of course, it's going to take them some time to get to the levels of a Netflix, but they definitely have the formula. When it comes to a Paramount, I think that's going to be a completely different story. The company is still losing money. It will probably lose about $1 billion, $1.2 billion. Plus, they have too many other distractions going on. With Warner Brothers Discovery, yes, they did turn a slight profit last year with, Max. But, Paul, you really have to kind of look at this in the context of the Warner Brothers Discovery business. I mean, HBO in its heyday, this is HBO, which has basically turned into the streaming business, in its heyday was generating $2 billion in EBITDA. And last year, they reported $100 million on their streaming business and EBITDA. And, if they want the street to be excited about that, I'm not so sure, investors are going to be too happy. So it's they're not going to be able to get to the level of profitability and definitely not going to be able to get to it in the time frame that investors are hoping that they would.
So Netflix might have won the battle there. But, Geetha, the one battle that seems yet to have been won is who's the dominant sports streaming place. You have Netflix with the WWE Raw deal, and then you have this other platform which we heard be announced earlier in this year, which, to be honest, I feel like I've heard nothing of since, the ESPN Fox Warner Bros. Discovery. I don't even think we still know what a name is. We don't know whether it's going to happen, whether Congress will even allow it to happen. How is that shaping up in terms of who becomes the go-to player to watch all of your live stream sports?
Yeah, that really is the question right now. And Danny, you kind of really hit the nail on the head there. We're going to have to wait and see what happens with, the joint venture, the ESPN, Fox, Warner Brothers. In the meantime, Disney has also said that they will take ESPN standalone over the top in 2025. But in the meantime, you do have all these tech giants kind of making a play for sports, right? Amazon, I think, to date has been the most aggressive. They have the Thursday Night Football package. They've now introduced ads on their service. They have a lot of the football content from Europe. So, they're definitely making a big play. And as you mentioned, Netflix too. I think the big thing that we are kind of really watching out for is this July 20th event where they're kind of dipping into live sports a little bit with the Mike Tyson versus Jake Paul. And that kind of then gives them, I think, allows them to gauge a little bit, what the appetite for live sports is. Because remember, again, WWE is a little bit of quasi sports. It's more what they call sports entertainment. But it's going to be interesting to see whether they really want to go really aggressive with sports. I think if they want to build their advertising business, I think it is a critical piece that is missing for them right now. And so there is this chatter and this speculation about whether they're even going to be this dark horse bidder for the NBA negotiations that are currently ongoing.
All right, Geetha, let's switch gears to our good friends at Paramount. The stock's up about 10% today. The news, I guess, is Paramount shares jump as Apollo and Sony are said to weigh a joint bid out there. What's the latest there? Are we going to get some kind of deal here for some of Paramount, all of Paramount? How do you think it shakes out?
I certainly hope so, Paul. I mean, it's so Sony kind of getting into this equation. I think they are the most credible bidder to date. And, you know, I really hope that they come in with something that kind of entices the Paramount board to engage with them. Because remember, the Apollo bid before for $26 billion, I mean, there were just, or at least the way management spun it was that, you know, there were all these financing concerns. So this, I think, definitely, you know, will have a lot of firepower because the Skydance deal that Paramount is currently engaged in, there's just been so much of backlash against that deal because what most of the common shareholders have felt is that it is only going to benefit the Redstone family. It is going to dilute all of the other shareholders. So there is all of that going on. Meanwhile, you had four board members that kind of left, you know, suddenly. Again, that kind of screams a hard no. So the Skydance deal as it stands right now really seems fraught with litigation risk, which is why I think Sony coming in is kind of a welcome change and investors will definitely cheer that.
But to be clear, Sherry Redstone doesn't need to let the other shareholders have a say or have a vote, right, in how this goes?
She doesn't need to, but she should. I mean, she does have a fiduciary responsibility.
Well, it's funny. We were speaking, Tom Keene and I, earlier today with Chris Marenghi, who's a co-CIO at Gabelli Funds. And Gabelli is, they own the control shares. Mm. They don't own the non-voting. They own the voting shares. They're the second largest owner after the Redstone Trust here. And he seemed to imply that, you know, he thinks the company should treat all shareholders, I guess, similarly. But again, as you mentioned, they don't have to, assuming they want to take some litigation risks. Is that kind of how you think about it, Keitha?
Yeah, I think, you know, that's what they don't have to. You're absolutely right. I mean, Sherry Redstone can pretty much do whatever she wants. The problem is, you know, the other shareholders are going to definitely revolt. There's already been so much of public protest and backlash. Not that that has stopped her. But again,
yep.
We'll have to see.
Yeah, it's amazing. And again, there, I just rewind my investment banking clock, you know, 5 years, 10 years. And what you could have gotten, what this company could have been paid for a change of control would have just been multiples of where we are today. It's just kind of sad to see how the value has declined.
And probably the idea of a dual class share back then was different. People are looking at it different than they are at this very moment.
Yeah, exactly. It's been something that media investors have had to deal with for a long time. Geetha Ranganathan, thank you so much for joining us. Geetha is the media analyst for Bloomberg Intelligence, one of the best media analysts out there on the street. We love getting a few minutes of her time joining us from the Princeton campus of Bloomberg. Have you ever been down to the Bloomberg offices in Princeton?
You know, I never have. Just moved back to New York, Paul. You got to give me time. Give me time.
That's right.
How
long were you in London for?
Almost 7 years.
Wow.
Yeah.
Good.
Yeah.
Back in New York.
So now I'll do the Bloomberg U.S. road trip. Now that I'm back.
Very good.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Intelligence Podcast. Catch us live weekdays at 10 a.m. Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. You can also listen live on Amazon Alexa from our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
Danny, we've been talking about this market. It's rallied hard off the October lows, you know, at one point up about 25% off those October lows. And a lot of smart market people are saying, we do need to see some pullbacks, some drawdowns, maybe something more than 2% to kind of, it's okay for a healthy market. So here we are today, we're down about 4.5%, maybe 5% on the S&P 500. The question is that it? I mean, is that kind of the pullback? Nicole Webb joins us, Senior Vice President and Financial Advisor for Wealth Enhancement Group, joining us here in our Bloomberg Interactive Broker Studio. So Nicole, what do you tell your clients these days about kind of the ups and downs of this market? Again, we've had a nice strong move off those October lows. What do you tell them about where you think this market's going to go?
I mean, pauses and pullbacks are part of a healthy market. I mean, we can't run further from here. To think it would happen in a straight line is, you know, that's what makes us uncomfortable. When we see things trajectory up and to the right for too long, that's when you start to get a little bit concerned about over-enthusiasm. And so this pause for us is well warranted. I think, does the pullback have room from here? You know, I think there's a lot riding on big tech earnings, and I think we can't be overly dismissive of that. It has been the defensive play for many years in a row now. And there's a lot riding on that forward guidance. And we're a bit of the camp that there's probably a deacceleration of earnings from those names and an acceleration of earnings in other sectors of the market in the back half of this year. And I think you saw a little bit of that play out with Netflix, and there's a big response.
Yeah. Again, the irony is this idea that on the way up, we're freaking out, or not we,
I know.
Perhaps me, freaking out that it can't go on. And when it starts to fall, we freak out the other way. How much further will it have to fall? But it's interesting you say back half of the year, other companies pick up the mantle. So is this less of a sell-off and more of a beginning of a leadership change?
Yeah, and I mean, there's a lot going on in markets today. And I think it's a truly incredible time to be an investor. Anytime you see the 10-year pushing 5%, you have to have a real conversation with your clients. And working on our side of the business, you know, we're not beholden to only one mandate. We're cross-asset for families. And so to us, you have to have real conversations about excess return above expectations from equities and what you do with that. And when you have a 10-year that is pushing 5% on a net real return after tax basis, you start to go, okay, well, if I was expecting 7 or 8 from equities over that same 10-year period, is it prudent of me now to start to think about repositioning? And so, you know, I think this is one of those kind of not the most overused word of 2024. This is another bifurcation of what are you doing right now? Is it a long only strategy? Are you cross asset? Are you invested across all sectors? And then how are you looking at this market today as full of opportunity for that?
You have a 60-40 outlook, 60% of portfolio in equities, 40% in bonds. Is that something you guys do, or do you just get a little bit more creative than that?
Definitely more prescriptive than that. And I would say, you know, we are big proponents of the third leg of that stool, which, you know, it would be in the world of alternative investments, real assets, you know, really looking at underlying risk. You know, the unique thing about equity markets today is that we have less shares available. There's just less publicly traded companies. And so when you take that into consideration, I think for people who have the access or the lack of liquidity needs, you know, the private investment spectrum has been a big part of overall asset allocation.
In terms of this idea that higher yields, I get that all of a sudden you have something that's an attractive alternative to equities, but just in the mechanism of that forcing equities to sell off, is it different that the reason that we have higher yields is because the U.S. economy is strong, and the U.S. economy is strong enough that we don't need to cut? Presumably that's, again, in a roundabout way, a good thing for equities.
Yes. So, and this is where I was saying there's so much to unpack. You know, I think this is where the story of the inversion of the yield curve, which I've been talking about, I feel like since 2018, it's just ad nauseum. But what if you really break it down to what is it telling us in the moment, it's telling us that there's long duration demand for U.S. Treasuries, and that growth is so strong, and that the consumer has strength to the extent that we want to slow them down. So when we think about earnings and we think about earnings growth, which at the end of the day should be a big part of the representation of the valuation of the market, well, then when we look at not just U.S. GDP, but we start to focus further on the IMF global growth numbers, China GDP, China stimulus, this is where I think you start to really see, okay, yes, we're in a pullback, and there's still likely room for this market to grow from here, but there's going to be fits and stops to that growth trajectory.
You mentioned on the fixed income side, you can get, you know, a nice return on a 2-year, on a 10-year treasury. How about going out and taking some credit risk? Is that something you're advising your clients these days, whether it's investment grade or even high yield?
Yeah, and I think you have to be both tactical and active with your fixed income portfolio. You know, I think this is where you speak to anyone who works directly on the behalf of any families. You start to really look at that, you know, net after tax equivalent basis on your fixed income portfolio. And so, you know, we have taken on, you know, credit risk across the spectrum. And we're just utilizing, again, going back to kind of that prescriptive mandate where we are a bit more creative because we work for families.
Nicole, I love how you put gold right now, saying that gold as an expression of discomfort. I think that's perfect because so many of us have been scratching our heads saying, what's up with gold? Is this kind of, the only asset class to express that discomfort at the moment?
I mean, there's a lot. If you look across the commodity spectrum right now, there's a lot of reasons to feel uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. I mean, I was speaking to one of our analysts. I'm like, talk to me about commodities. And he's like, drought, geopolitical drought, this. And you're just like, okay, I just got uncomfortable. How do I express my discomfort? You know, for us, gold doesn't really play a meaningful place in portfolio construction simply because, you know, of the components of what gold is. And so when we see a response like this, it's funny because gold can go in a couple of different ways. It can be both exuberant and it can also be discomfort. And right now we think it's an expression of discomfort across the commodity spectrum.
Dare I suggest, do you have a view on Bitcoin, crypto, that kind of stuff?
What are your halving?
When your clients call you up and say they want to get exposure to crypto, what do you say?
You know, I think crypto, and this goes back to something we were all saying before we came on air, cryptocurrency, and I'm going to focus specifically on Bitcoin, but it is a supply and demand mechanism. And so if you know, the thing that hit me the hardest when I was learning about Bitcoin over the years was, you know, if you believe that the demand for Bitcoin is going to increase by more than 2% per year because the supply is only going to increase by more than 2% per year, then you should probably be long Bitcoin.
Yep.
I'm not saying that that's the advice I'm giving to individual clients or that's our firm's thesis on cryptocurrency. But, you know, I think, you know, what you always want to boil things down, boil down what markets are, boil down what Bitcoin is. Yep. And at the end of the day, you know, I think this conversation about halving has a lot to do with that supply and demand mechanism long term.
Very good. Nicole, thank you so much for joining us. Nicole Webb, Senior Vice President, Financial Advisor at Wealth Enhancement Group, joining us live here in our Bloomberg Interactive Broker Studio.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. You need a company with extensive experience in specialized insurance. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and helping provide coverage that suits your needs. The Hartford offers insurance solutions that help mid to large-sized businesses like yours effectively manage risk, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. With extensive experience in underwriting, risk engineering services, and claims, The Hartford goes beyond the expected to deliver innovative, customizable solutions and service that your industry, that your business, demands. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Success is more than the final destination. It's a path you take one step at a time. It's discipline, it's teamwork, and it's the drive and passion inside of us that comes before all recognition. It's what Stifel's been doing for over 130 years. Quietly, yet strategically, Stifel's become one of the fastest growing wealth management and investment banking firms in the country. Our financial advisors go beyond traditional wealth management to provide clients with direct access to one of the industry's largest equity research franchises and a leading middle market investment bank. Because success is the drive it takes to keep climbing, the passion to keep investing, the best of each of us made better by the best in all of us. And that is where success meets success. Start your journey at Stifel.com. That's Stifel.com.
Stifel Nicolaus and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Intelligence Podcast. Catch us live weekdays at 10 a.m. Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. You can also listen live on Amazon Alexa from our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
Paul Sweeney live here in a Bloomberg Interactive Brokers studio in New York City. We're also streaming live on YouTube. So head over to YouTube.com and search Bloomberg Podcast, and that's where you'll find it. All right, a lot of market participants, a lot of market observers are saying, you know what, part of a strong, healthy market is an occasional pullback, a drawdown, as the kids call it. I'm not sure. We're off about 5% here on the S&P 500 from our recent highs. Does that qualify? Let's check in with Barry Ritholtz. He's a host of Masters in Business on Bloomberg Radio. He's also the founder of Ritholtz Wealth Management. He joins us via Zoom here. Hey, Barry, I mean, do you ascribe to that kind of thinking that every good long-term bull market needs some healthy pullbacks? And if so, are we in the midst of one of those now, do you think?
Wait, markets go up and down? Nobody told me about this. I thought they just went straight up and it was easy to make a ton of money.
Exactly.
Listen, this is the nature of a broad, deeply participated, enormous market capitalization exchange. This is what happens. You know, the ideas that drive markets kind of get tested out. They catch fire for a little while, then they sort of get overlooked, and then the narrative changes. And you know, we've figured this out. I love the expression, investing is a problem that's been solved, but investing is something that takes place over decades, and month to month, week to week, day to day, tick to tick, that's fairly random. There's a lot of noise and a lot of emotion that, wait, we're up 25% from the lows. Wait, we're down 10% from the highs. It's everybody making their best guess as to the discounted cash flow of stocks and where profits are going to be in the future relative to the risk-free rate of return of bonds.
And Barry, you mentioned where profits are going to be in the future. That brings our attention to earnings. It seems like the Fed story is still out there, but the Fed will be maybe less active in terms of cutting rates in the near term. So maybe focus needs to go a little bit more towards earnings. What are you looking for in terms of earnings here? Are you going to be listening for anything on some of these calls?
So I like to look at two things. I want to look at what is the overall beat rate, right? Most 2/3 of the companies will beat earnings expectations. We always laugh at when an earnings report misses the expectations. I think everybody gets it backwards. The earnings report is the earnings report. Your forecasts were wrong. They right. are what it was. You got it wrong. So I want to see how many companies are beating versus missing. I like to look at the overall level. Hey, what are we growing? Are we really adding 3-5% to profits? We're pretty close to all-time highs for profits for the S&P 500. But the thing that so many people find so challenging is it's not the number, it's not the data, it's what are the earnings relative to expectations. Netflix is a great example. I mean, that is a spectacular earnings report, the most new subscribers in a long time, revenue, profits, everything moving in the right direction, but apparently not as much as expected. And so despite, you know, the really solid report, the initial response was, oh, this is disappointing, which it's always about not the news, but how much of the news is already priced in.
And to that end, Barry, what do you think of companies providing kind of point guidance, whether it's a quarter out or a year out? I mean, is that something they should be doing to kind of manage the whole process, or should they just run their business and let the street take care of it?
You know, I am not a big fan of, you know, back in the old days when you and I were first
yep.
getting started, they used to be called whisper numbers yep. before Reg FD. A handful of favored analysts or axes on the stock would get a very quiet conversation with the CFO or the CEO. Hey, you have us at 7 cents a share. You should really be close to 9 cents a share. And, you know, so everybody would be low, and the one guy the day before would change his estimate, and lo and behold, everybody rushes to raise and the stock takes off. That sort of nonsense from when we were youngsters on trading desks, that's all gone. So now everybody has to get the disclosure at the same time. And I wonder how helpful it is being that precise. I love hearing a CEO saying, hey, listen, you know, we're expecting to see growth this quarter, similar to last quarter, but we don't know what's happening with fill in the blank, the yep. war in the Middle East or the Ukraine. There seems to be a lot of inflation stuck in the services part of the economy. So we're going to give you a range and try not to micromanage this. And I think that's just honest, because we really don't know what the future holds. When someone pretends, they're setting themselves up for failure.
All right, Barry, I'm looking at some social media from our good friend Matt Miller, and he's now showing, it looks like he's test driving, the Lamborghini Huracan Sterrato, and he notes that it's among the last of the naturally aspirated V10s in production, whatever that is. Does that kind of car get your attention?
So I am. So I'm not a big Lambo fan. That's not my. It's a little too flashy for me. Paul, you know what a low key, quiet guy I am, and the Lambo, in that like lime green, is a little too much for me. That said, I gotta give Lamborghini credit for saying, "Wait, a $400,000 rocket ship? I know. Let's turn it into a Dakar off-road racer. Let's raise it a few inches, put some plastic cladding and high-intensity light beams and some off-road tires, and let this 700-horsepower monster loose, you know, in the Sahara." Kudos to them for stepping out of their comfort zone. The crazy thing about this Sturato is it, not only does it have a giant premium over the usual Lamborghini Hurricanes, it sold out instantly.
Wow.
And every time people tell me, and admittedly, this is not exactly a middle-class purchase, but wherever I look, cars, watches,
yep,
restaurant reservations, yep, every time someone tells me how bad the economy is, where do you live? What? And I'm not just in New York. I'm around the country pretty,
yep,
regularly. I was just in Salt Lake City. I was in Vegas. I was in California. And not like, yep, Beverly Hills, but like middle class parts.
Yeah, exactly.
Yep.
The wealth effect is real.
It's hard not to look around and, yep, say, if you think this economy stinks,
all right, we have to leave it there, Barry.
Rethink where you live.
Barry, very much thank you. Host of Masters in Business on Bloomberg Radio, founder of Ritholtz Wealth Management as well. Appreciate that little car talk to finish off your morning.
This is the Bloomberg Intelligence Podcast, available on Apple, Spotify, and anywhere else you get your podcasts. Listen live each weekday, 10 a.m. to noon Eastern, on Bloomberg.com, the iHeartRadio app, TuneIn, and the Bloomberg Business app. You can also watch us live every weekday on YouTube and always on the Bloomberg Terminal.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Collaborate for a greener future at the Bloomberg Green Festival, a groundbreaking celebration of the thinkers, doers, and innovators leading the way, from design and culture to technology, science, and entertainment. Hear from inspirational speakers and immerse yourself in climate solutions, July 10th through 13th in Seattle. Title sponsor, Amazon. Official airline, Alaska Airlines. Get 20% off using promo code RADIO20 at BloombergLive.com/greenfestival.